Tonight on Arena, we look forward to season two of This Time with Alan Partridge and new albums from Teenage Fan Club, Marianne Faithfull and Warren Ellis, and Adrian Crowley up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Steve Coogan's beloved broadcaster Alan Partridge returns for a second series of This Time with Alan Partridge on BBC One tonight, accompanied by the eternally patient fellow host Jenny Gresham, played by Susanna Fielding. The series follows Alan as he is now established as the show's co-presenter, but is battling behind the scenes to keep his spot. This is how the first episode opens.
The distance to the studio is exactly 80 metres. Most presenters cover it in 60 seconds. We do it in 40. Thanks, Rachel. Emerging from the dot on my right is...
Jenny Gresham, hello. And welcome to the show that covers the full spectrum of human life.
From aqua aerobics to abortion. From zebras to Zionism.
The show that promises to be all things...
to all men.
And all women.
And everything in between. Hi, Nathan, Jermaine, Shauna and Trent. It's that time.
What time?
High time to say if you've got time to give this time your time... then it's time to let this time spend time making your time a good time. On This Time.
Only takes me 30 seconds to make it from the desk to the studio. That is the opening of This Time with Alan Partridge, which will be broadcast on BBC One television this evening. Joined now by self-confessed Alan Partridge nerd, Jen Gannon, who, yes, she's watched the first episode, but an hour ago tweeted... talking about one of the loves of my life on at RTE Arena tonight, Alan Gordon Partridge, # back of the net. You're a happy woman, clearly.
I am. I feel like I've lived in that travelodge with him since, you know, the time of It's Alan Partridge. And feel like I'm very close to Alan, like we all are. I think if anyone is a slight fan, you feel like you know the ins and outs of his life.
Yeah, that opening sequence, I mean, it's so slick. And as you're watching it as well, they're walking and talking from Alan Partridge's dressing room down the corridors, passing everybody along the way. The writing here, the performances here, really tight.
Yeah, it's, you know, thoroughly steeped in those bland but very telling exchanges we constantly see, and we just take them for granted on those type of magazine shows. And, you know, that it kind of, there's a moment in it where he manages to both mock that kind of empty lip service of PC culture at the BBC whilst also deriding those who are uncomfortable with the inclusivity of modern living. And that's just a certain type of genius and precise detail that comes as no surprise to anyone who's been watching, you know, Alan Partridge for the past, you know, best part of 30 years at this stage. I mean, Alan is just such a well-constructed, really skillfully conceived character, and that universe that he inhabits perfectly aligns with the reality of a certain type of male presenter that he's almost managed to kind of supplant the people that, you know, Steve Coogan's Alan has kind of supplanted the people he's lampooning at this stage.
and Norwich, poor old Norwich. What did it do to deserve a presenter like Alan Partridge?
They're shining hope, actually. They should have a statue of him in Norwich. I mean, it really is like he's this perfect amalgamation of all those people like Richard Madeley or Jeremy Clarkson or Noel Edmonds. And, you know, he can't take them seriously anymore because of that. Like he inhabits like their worst habits, their outmoded opinions, their oversized egos. He could be truly be one of their contemporaries. And I think the Little Englander, the pro-Brexit part of the recent culture wars that so many television hosts of a certain era have become involved with through, you know, newspaper columns or what have you, have added this other kind of richness to Alan as a character, which I just think is blissful. Like, it's so good.
Let's have a listen to it's a little bit further. It's not much further into the first episode, in fact. They've now done the walk and talk from the dressing room to the studio. They're sitting down on the chair beside each other. That is Jenny Gresham, his co-host Susanna Fielding, and Alan Partridge, Steve Coogan. And here's the introduction proper to the programme.
But yes, slightly different opening tonight, prompted, I should say, by a letter from Ewan Anderson of Disley Road Primary School in Oldham.
He wrote simply to ask, please, can we see the inside of your dressing room?
And we were happy to oblige, or Alan was.
Jenny's dressing room is off limits. The only way to see inside a lady's dressing room at the BBC would be to get a time machine and set the coordinates for the 1970s. Which we know was good and bad.
Besides, there's not really much to see in my dressing room anyway.
No, it's beautiful. Loads of smelly candles, lots of photographs of you with all the famous people you've met. And she's got a little sign above the mirror which says simply, never ever compromise. Lovely.
But yes, happy to know that we have younger viewers tuning in. Ewan, thanks very much for getting in touch.
Yeah, obviously a keen interest in telly.
Well, who knows, maybe one day he'll be running the BBC.
Yeah. Oh, no. He attends state school.
Another clip there from This Time with Alan Partridge, episode 1 of season 2, which starts tonight on BBC One television. But it is so clever, Jen Gannon, in the midst of all of that. They really hit home on lampooning the type of the PC culture, but at the same time lampooning those who aren't PC. They get everybody in.
They do. And that's the thing about it. Like, as with all comedy, the hilarity stems from how seriously the writers and Steve Coogan take that character. He's such a sustainable character because they have invested so much time on him that they have, you know, created him as this fully rounded personification that Steve Coogan has inhabited. And, you know, that can be to his detriment. I mean, we've seen through the lens of Michael Winterbottom, his really sublime meta-comedy, The Trip, that's the Steve Coogan of The Trip, dislikes being greeted with Alan Partridge's aha catchphrase just as much as Alan Partridge does. And it's like a mirror in a mirror, and you'll never get closer to the real Steve Coogan. And it is a strange one, because I've read an interview with him in The Guardian a few years ago. We said, you know, sometimes, especially now as he's gotten older, he doesn't know where Alan ends and he begins. And we're that close to Alan too, that Steve Coogan the person has almost slightly dissolved, and it's a very neat trick that he's pulled as a person to do that.
I'd say both a neat trick and an awful pain in the face sometimes. Yeah. Because there are times, you know, when you say, oh, there's Alan Partridge, realise, no, it's not Alan Partridge, it's Steve Coogan. What about and I guess one of the reasons that it works so well is they play that as the two presenters, as Anna Feeling and Steve Coogan. They play the lines absolutely straight, as a presenter must when delivering lines, no matter what he or she thinks about those lines. You know, if you're going to say them on air, you've got to believe them. So you should believe them before you get down the stairs, I guess, is the lesson there. But they really play everything absolutely straight.
Yeah, and I think this time basically is the BBC's one show in a parallel universe. Like, the one show itself has, if anyone's seen it, has this breakneck speed when it comes to their bizarre mix of features. Like, there was a moment that I urge anybody to watch on YouTube, you can get it, where Mel Brooks is on the show and he is totally bemused as they just happily segued from talking about his musical version of Young Frankenstein to a really harrowing piece about a woman looking for her long lost father. And it feels like something so strange it could be beyond parody, but they have managed to do that with This Time. And I think that magazine show format is perfect for the character of Alan, because it jams in everything from the banal to the profound, like you said in that clip, like from zebras to Zionism. And I think that's perfect for him, and it's so unpredictable, and it has him dealing with the public. And there is a studied awkwardness or a certain awkwardness to those type of live shows where brief pauses can feel like an hour long and they're beset with technical difficulties and have truculent guests. And This Time manages just to capture all of that. And I think this season they've even taken it a little bit further with the behind the scenes moments. So that adds an extra layer to it. And then you have the return of their reporters, like Lolly Adefope plays the reporter Ruth Duggan, whose contempt for Alan just drips off the screen. And then you have someone like the brilliant Susanna Fielding, who's playing Jenny Gresham. And, you know, she might be the straight man, but she plays that gritted teeth determination and, you know, deflated resignation at the same time of Jenny, with this real startling accuracy that you could just plant her into the one show itself straight away. It gives it this other layer of legitimacy when you're watching it.
Because I was going to actually ask you about the importance of her role in all of this, Susanna Fielding. She has a permanent white-toothed smile on her face, as the character that is, as Jenny Gresham, which again is that style of presentation in some ways. You can't really, the success, certainly Alan Partridge is a whole separate Steve Coogan creation. You can't underestimate how important that straight person at the side is to what Steve Coogan can do.
Yeah, you need that anchor as always, like to make it, it makes it funnier, obviously, and it's her interactions with Alan and their dynamic together that works so well, because it's almost in that way where we've all seen Richard and Judy for years on This Morning, and even though they were a married couple, how annoyed and the glances and, you know, the looks that Judy could give Richard at some stage, and that's what you're getting from this pairing, and it's that's why it works so well, because it is based on a true that we all recognise.
See it all the time.
Yeah.
What about the fact that there's a great twin brothers story in the first episode, but the writers here are twin brothers, Neil and Rob Gibbons?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because at the beginning, you know, it was Steve Coogan, Armando Iannucci, and Patrick Marber and Peter Bainham, and they worked all together on Alan Partridge on The Day Today and on the radio show on The Hour, and they fleshed out the character and finding that very specific deluded voice that we know of Alan, and those writers obviously moved on to bigger things, and Coogan was worried that Alan would be retired completely, and he found these comedy writers, Neil and Rob Gibbons, they're twin brothers who were employed in 2008 on his tour to write for the characters Paul and Pauline Calf, but they'd grown up with Alan Partridge and they could, you know, easily kind of slip into that distinctive mindset. So they've been responsible for Alan Partridge era Mark II. So that would be the film Alpha Papa, Mid Morning Matters, the small show on Sky, and the mockumentaries Welcome to the Places in My Life and This Time, and the book and the podcast as well, from The Oathouse. And I think they really have him nailed. They have it perfectly done. And, you know, they were saying in an interview recently with The Guardian that Steve Coogan doesn't understand how hard he works them in a way that they looked at a calendar one day and they realised he had no days off. They had no days off until like Christmas Day, and they actually had to ask, can we just take a step back from Alan for a moment? That's how invested they all are with it.
And he probably said no.
Yeah, in a Stanley Kubrick style. Like.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a clip from the first season, in fact, the last season of This Time with Alan Partridge. There's a guest here called, he's from Mayo, Martin Brennan, played by Steve Coogan as well. I mean, is there no end to the man's stuff? Yeah, a few controversial tunes and themes here.
Tell her how the IRA made you run like Calloway, run the green and lovely lanes of Kilashandra. Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man should stand behind the men behind the wire.
Come on, Simon!
Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man should stand behind the men behind the wire.
Ah, that was grand, that. Yeah, that. Mighty. Yeah. Double O fecking bollocks.
Oh, my God, that was like an advert for the IRA.
There you go. You know, see, he kind of knows his Irish themes as well, does Steve Coogan. You've got all that stuff. Obviously, the film Philomena, which he directed. And didn't he direct that as well as starring it? You know, he knows what he's at. And you can see how close to the bone he goes with when you get something close to home.
He was also in Moon Boy as well. And he did a great Irish accent in that as well. He was a fish farmer. And he's one of the very few people that can master that Irish accent perfectly, I think. And he really does seem to relish playing those characters, and especially someone like Martin Brennan. And I think there was something really anarchic about hearing Come Out You Black and Tans on the BBC, like even then. And I just think to sneak that song in like that was genius. And it even re-entered the charts after that because of that.
Okay. Yeah. Stephen Frears, of course, I'm just being corrected there quite rightly. It was Stephen Frears who directed Philomena, but Steve Coogan in it. And he was brilliant in it.
And Leonardo DiCaprio, who couldn't pronounce it.
No, not he wasn't in Philomena.
No, but he couldn't pronounce it when he went to talk about it.
Oh, yes, on it. Right. Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, listen, you're recommending that we go to watch the man you love most this evening on television,
yes,
the love of your life,
definitely.
Jen. Definitely.
Yes? I mean, I think, you know, Alan, if he wants to retire Alan at any stage, which he probably will, you know, I think he's given us enough to obsess over. And I think Alan Partridge as a character is so well conceived that he will live on in the cultural memory, I think, longer than any of those actual presenters he was based on originally. Funnily enough.
There you go. Just to think that you could put one presenter ahead of another. I don't know how you could do such a thing.
Disgraceful.
Exactly. Jen, thanks for that. That's Jen Gannon, and This Time with Alan Partridge begins on BBC One, 9:30 this evening. Friday Opera Explorer is a new 5-part series of online concerts from Irish National Opera. It takes place every Friday at 5 p.m. Each week will feature an interview with a composer, a contemporary composer, and a selection of arias from a particular country, Italy, France, Russia or Germany. And those arias will be performed by singers, including the soprano Claudia Boyle and tenor Gavin Ring. The composers are well known from Bellini through to Wagner, but the operas are new to INO's repertoire. Claudia Boyle and composer Emma O'Halloran join me now. Claudia, you were singing, in fact, earlier this evening, 5 p.m, the arias by Bellini and Donizetti as part of the first concert. So what exactly is the idea behind Friday Opera Explorer?
Well, I mean, as the name suggests, it's to explore opera. So it basically takes you on a journey through opera, focusing really on composers from France, Germany, Italy and Russia. And also not necessarily pieces you might know or operas that you might be overly familiar with. So, you know, for instance, we have Tchaikovsky, who'd be really well known for something like Eugene Onegin, but we've actually featured the opera Iolanta. So it's kind of slightly lesser known operas too, which makes it really, really interesting.
Yeah, in fact, and you're performing as part of that Iolanta story. How different is the Tchaikovsky's that we get in the operatic world to the Tchaikovsky that we get in the big symphonic and the big, you know, he gives us such great orchestral and balletic music?
Oh yeah, I mean his balletic music is just it's sublime. But you know, I think his opera is just as good. You know, he's one of the foremost prolific composers for a reason. His music is outstanding. It's luscious. It's romantic. It's full of sweeping melodies. So his capacity for all that is second to none. And you will certainly hear that in his operas too.
Yeah, and we have a recording of you performing a piece from Iolanta. Can you give us the context so that we can listen to a little bit of this?
Yeah, I can indeed. So this is Ochevone da Priege de Nesniala, which basically means, why did I not know this before? And here we have the Princess Iolanta, who was blind. And she's been blind her whole life, but she's only realising now that something is missing. So she's never been told that she's blind. And so she's a wonderful character, very simple, but there's a real yearning in her singing. And this poignant aria really brings that across.
Well, let's have a listen. I'll go for the English translation. Why did I not know this before? Thank you for that. Claudia Boyle singing. And she's accompanied by Aoife O'Sullivan here on piano. Why did I not know this until now? Or why until now have I not shed tears? Another translation there of the Tchaikovsky aria that we heard. Claudia Boyle performing Aoife O'Sullivan on piano. And that's part of the Friday Opera Explorer series. That one, Claudia, will be broadcast, the Russian one, on the 21st of May. You'll be dealing with lots of different Russian operas will be in the midst of that.
Yes.
But also with us this evening is Emma O'Halloran, who will be the...
Hello.
Hi, Emma. How are you doing? Good to speak with you. You're the opera composer that will be interviewed on Friday, the 7th of May, in the Opera Explorer series there.
Mm-hmm.
Just from the contemporary composer's point of view, how difficult a situation or how difficult an arena is it, the contemporary opera composer? It's a big, big task to compose a contemporary opera, I would have thought.
It's a challenge, all right. It's a bit of a marathon, I guess. It's just with longer works, you really have to, you know, pace yourself and figure out how all things are connected. But, you know, it's really wonderful to be able to work with a company like Irish National Opera to even be given a chance to put your music and your big vision on the stage is incredible. So it's great to be part of it.
You worked with INO before on a piece called The Wait. This was a short opera as part of their 20 Shots of Opera production. What was involved there, Emma?
So Irish National Opera commissioned 20 composers to write, to each write a short 5-minute opera, kind of very much suggesting whatever was on their mind now, kind of during the time of the pandemic, and they were filmed and released online. So for me, I texted a friend, Naomi Louise O'Connell, who's going to be singing in one of the, I think she was singing today actually, in the Opera Explorer series.
And she was,
I
yes.
asked her, did she want to sing? And she was interested, and then I texted my uncle, who's a librettist, and he wrote a libretto, and then I wrote the music for it.
Your uncle, who's Mark O'Halloran, who's also a bit of a filmmaker as well as a librettist, a bit of a playwright and a bit of an actor as well as all of those things. So that we have a piece from The Wait. Do you know the piece that we're about to hear? While the waters are rising outside, a woman sits upstairs in her house waiting. Is that that's the context that we need for what Naomi Louise is singing about here?
It is, yeah.
All right. Well, let's have a listen to Naomi Louise O'Connell, and it's I think this is an opera. This is an orchestral piece. Elaine Kelly is the conductor. Just a little taster there of Naomi Louise O'Connell, mezzo-soprano, in that performance. Remember O'Halloran's short opera, The Wait. I love the kind of tension that you're building there. She's waiting for the waters to rise up and she clearly knows she's in quite a tense situation there, Emma.
Yeah, it's not so lighthearted. it's amazing. Like, opera is so fun to work with, like, as a medium, because the text really tells you kind of what the music is going to do. So it's really opened up a new sort of avenue for me in terms of being creative, and I love it.
Yeah, and are you working with Mark, with your uncle Mark O'Halloran, on an opera version of Trade, his play Trade?
I am, yeah. That is hopefully will be premiered in January 22 and in America, and then hopefully Ireland later on that year. But Trade is it's a brilliant play, and it's so spacious in terms of Mark tends to be very economic with the words that he uses. So there's a lot of room for the music to come in and do its thing. So I'm really excited about it.
And again, certainly in the play version of that, when it was originally performed, it was in a very confined space. Are you, and use of the confined space there in The Wait, are you in a confined space again here, or is it opening out into something slightly more open for an operatic performance, operatic realisation?
I think the sound will be bigger, but it'll still be an encounter that takes place in a room, and the whole show will be in one room. But I think hopefully it will sort of expand out, and it'll feel more expansive than The Wait.
Yeah, okay. And I suppose we're talking about opening out. And Claudia, to come back to you, Claudia Boyle, what did you make of the yesterday's news about opening out again? No definite news yet of venues and theatres, but have you any kind of hope for that we might get something towards the summer or autumn period?
Yeah, well, I have my fingers and toes crossed, Sean. I mean, it's been a long year. It's been over a year, and certainly, I mean, I can say for everybody that it's, you know, I mean, this particular sector, along with the hospitality sector, of course, and others, you know, very similar, has just been decimated. So, I mean, we're all hopeful, and while projects like this are absolutely fantastic, I think everybody is yearning for an audience, and that's why we sing. I mean, our opera singers don't generally sing with microphones. We're trained to sing acoustically, and that's to sing to an audience, a live audience. So fingers crossed. I mean, I'm hoping for a slightly back to normal autumn, but you know, we'll just have to wait and see. But unfortunately, there was nothing really concrete for the arts in the announcements. But listen, it's all a step forward, so you know, you have to be hopeful.
Yeah, well, we must maintain that hope, and I'm sure for you too, Emma. Even as a composer, yes, you can work by yourself, but when it comes to opera, it's a big collaboration. You do need to be in a room with singers, with people. You need to be in spaces doing performing as well as up in the garret composing.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not, you spend so much time on your own composing anyway that the pandemic has been heavy to deal with. But yeah, it's incredible. And you only really get a sense of whether a scene is going to work when you have everybody in a room together. And that's really magical. So yeah, fingers and toes crossed that we'll be able to do that sometime soon.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for both of you, to both of you for speaking with us this evening. Claudia Boyle, singer, and Emma O'Halloran, composer. Claudia was on earlier on the Friday Opera Explorer series. She'll also be there on the 21st of May as part of the Russian programme. And next Friday the 7th of May, Emma O'Halloran is the composer who will be interviewed there. There'll be arias from Beethoven's Fidelio, Wagner's Das Rheingold, and Tannhäuser, Sinead Campbell-Wallace, Brenton Ryan, Ben McAteer, and others involved in that performance as well. Friday Opera Explorer, 5 p.m. every Friday through until the 20th of May, broadcast via Facebook and YouTube. You'll get full details on irishnationalopera.ie. One of my favourite parts of the week, album reviews, final half hour of Friday's programme. First up, formed in 1989 near Glasgow, Teenage Fan Club were a defining band for a generation of 1990s indie kids. Classic third album, Bandwagon-esque, turns 30 this year, believe it or not. But today they give us a new album called Endless Arcade. Singer-songwriter and actress Marianne Faithfull has put together an album of personal interpretation, well-known poems by some of the great Romantic era poets, all set to music with collaborator Warren Ellis. Contributions from the likes of Brian Eno as well. The album takes its name from a poem by Byron, She Walks in Beauty. And finally, born in Malta, raised in Galway, singer-songwriter Adrian Crowley scooped the Choice Music Award of the Year prize in 2009 with his album Season of the Sparks. His ninth album is entitled The Watchful Eye of the Stars. It's out today, and the third one that we will be reviewing. Alan Corr and Lauren Murphy have been listening. We'll start with Teenage Fan Club. Endless Arcade is the title of the album. Here's a track called Home. Home, the title of that track from Endless Arcade, latest album from Teenage Fan Club. Lauren Murphy and Alan Corr, as I said, have been listening. This is the first album that we've got, Lauren's, from the Teenage Fan Club, without founding member Gerard Love. He left the band in 2018. Quite a shake-up for them. He was one of the three songwriters and vocalists. Is this a very new Teenage Fan Club that we're getting here?
It is and it isn't, I guess. I guess the fact that Gerard Love, who, like you said, was one of the three songwriters and vocalists in the band, has left means that the songwriting and singing is now split between Norman Blake and Raymond McGinley. But they've drafted in Eros Childs, who was formerly best known for playing in the Welsh indie band Gorky Zygotic Monkey years ago. And he's now on keyboards, and they've shifted around their members to play different things. And I think that it's brought a new energy to the band. So while they still sound like, you know, old reliable Teenage Fan Club, the band that does the jangly pop stuff so well, there is a sense that there is a new sort of energy in the band, I think, and there's new stuff coming through.
Yeah, but we got it in that song, Sometimes Wonder If I'll Ever Be Home Again. You know, the sun is shining, the skies are grey. This is one of the songs that where Blake is very much to the fore in the songwriting. Norman Blake and his marital problems, I think, influenced particularly that song, Home, and another song, Sun Won't Shine on Me. Very downbeat aspect to it. Is that right across the album, or do we get a different flavour when McGinley's involved, Alan?
Well, I think there's always been an undercurrent of melancholia with the band. And as you say, maybe that has got something to do with Blake's recent kind of separation from his wife, and indeed the departure of Gerard Love. I think, you know, I've always found it kind of difficult to tell the difference between the three erstwhile songwriters in the band now that Blake has left. But I think, as Lauren says, there's a combination of kind of the bittersweet and the hopeful on this. And this is what they've always done. They're a band who know their three B's very well. That's the Birds, the Beatles, and Big Star. So they've always managed to kind of have that kind of you know, a very kind of a sense of kind of cool sang Freud, but also, you know, a sense of yearning, a kind of a yearning for home and love. So that melancholic thing is still going on. But this is a very upbeat album for me as well. It's full of rueful regret, but kind of twinkling wisdom. And it sounds absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, so the nostalgia is there as well. But there's also a bit of looking forward in tracks like The Future.
All I showed was a false dome that the dead was.
There you go. You were saying, Alan, just as I started that track up, that The Future is one of the absolute highlights of the album for you.
I think if you look back in even the earliest days of the band, the first album, Catholic Education, which was a shambolic guitar sprawl, and then Bandwagon-esque in 1991, that sense of melody and of that song there, The Future, it always kind of shines through. They're always kings of melody. It's like they can't help themselves. And I think The Future there is, it's a gorgeous kind of lovely strum of a song with those very self reflective lyrics. It's hard to walk into the future when your shoes are made of lead.
Yeah, and it might not be totally upbeat in those other sections, Lauren, but there's certainly a dreamier quality to the Norman Blake stuff, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Raymond McGinley has always been the songwriter that brings the kind of more sort of noodly guitar and experimental stuff to the band. And definitely it's more defined on this album, because probably there's only two songwriters instead of three this time. But as much as, you know, it's divided in terms of Norman Blake and Raymond McGinley songs, it is a really cohesive album. And I think it's the kind of album that a band only like Teenage Fan Club, who've been playing together for 30 years despite their, you know, various lineup changes, could make. There's a real sort of craft to this album, and a real time-worn sense of, you know, like they've been at it for ages, they know what they're doing, and it feels like a comfort blanket in a lot of ways.
Yeah, they're not reinventing the wheel, but they know what they're at. Stars from you.
Exactly.
Stars from you, Lauren.
I'd go 4 out of 5, really good album.
Solid 4 out of 5, really good 4 out of 5, I should say, from you. And what are you saying, Alan?
Yeah, I think this is a poised and gorgeous, beautiful summery sound. I'd also give it a very strong 4 out of 5. A
poised and gorgeous 4 out of 5, says
like
Alan
yourself.
Carr. you stop digging. That's a Teenage Fan Club and Endless Arcade. Let's move on then to She Walks in Beauty. Marianne Faithfull, icon of the 1960s, singer-songwriter and actress, worked with Warren Ellis on a new collection of songs based on poems from the Romantic poets. She Walks in Beauty, title of the album, of course, is that of the Lord Byron poem, and it is how the album opens. Let's have a listen.
Where thoughts serenely sweet express how pure, how dear their dwelling place. And on that cheek and o'er that brow, so soft, so calm, yet eloquent, the smiles that win, the tints that glow, but tell of days in goodness spent. A mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent.
Opening track and title track there from the new album from Marianne Faithfull and Warren Ellis, She Walks in Beauty, the Lord Byron poem. Obviously, she knows how to recite a poem, does Marianne Faithfull, Lauren?
She absolutely does. She has such a commanding presence, even over record. I mean, she has had a long-held ambition, apparently, to record an album of spoken word poetry, a whole album, I guess, set to music. She has dabbled in it, obviously, a lot over the years, as far back as her 1979 album, Broken English. But this is the first time that she's worked, I guess, with a musician like Warren Ellis in such a full album capacity. And absolutely, you can't fault her delivery or her presence on record. She sells every poem that she reads here, absolutely.
And who better to take on the Romantic poets with all of that, I suppose, edge of the seat type of living that many of the Romantic poets had? Marianne Faithfull is the perfect person to take on some of these poems, Alan.
Oh, absolutely. She's 74 now and she remains unbowed, despite her maybe because of that incredible, eventful and rough life. As you know, she's dealt with addiction and health problems. She's had a very bad last year. Indeed, she nearly died from COVID. She was in hospital for 22 days. She was on the verge of death several times. She's very honest, always a very honest person. I've interviewed her a couple of times and she really is the countess and the ultimate survivor from that swinging 60s London scene. And it's interesting to think that, you know, as well as kind of dabbling in the works of kind of Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill in the past, she's also done the poems of her friend Frank McGuinness, and she has huge connections with Ireland. And let's not forget her most famous song, As Tears Go by the Stones. It actually opens with a line from Lord Tennyson. So this kind of idea of doing the poems has been a long, as Lauren said, held ambition. But yes, I think the fact that she's lived that such a rough life has lent her voice that ravaged kind of quality, and it really does lend itself to these poems beautifully.
Yeah, although at times during the thing, I heard it, a tinge of the Judi Dench type of delivery. And that's a compliment, by the way. If you can sound like Judi Dench delivering a poem, I think you're doing a good job for sure. But she's very much her own woman in how she does this. It leaves, is there much space for Warren Ellis to do stuff here, Lauren?
There kind of wasn't for me, actually. I mean, obviously, Warren Ellis is a fantastic musician in his own right. He's best known, obviously, as part of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. And he's done lots of soundtrack work with Nick Cave as well over the years. And I kind of get that he's there to complement Marianne Faithfull's voice and not overpower it in any way.
Yeah.
And it must be tricky for any composer to do that, like, you know, remain in the background but create a sufficient atmosphere. But apart from one or two tracks, I kind of felt like it was just a little one note in places. It was very much the same thing kind of over and over again. And while there are moments of real beauty throughout the album, this kind of hazy, gauzy, fuzzy, shimmering soundtrack didn't really go anywhere.
You wanted to
ultimately
maybe, yeah, react a little bit more to the words of the poems. Yeah. Well, let's have a listen to a section. We won't listen to all of La Belle Dame Sans Merci. We'll maybe get a stanza or two.
Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge has withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, so haggard and so woebegone? The squirrel's granary is full, and the harvest done. I see a lily.
There you go. I can't let it all play because you have to listen to the whole thing if you start listening at all. But those opening lines of what, now, to be fair there, I think, Alan, Warren Ellis really gives us a kind of the weird atmosphere. I remember learning What Can Ail Thee, Knight at Arms, Alone and Palely Loitering, La Belle Dame Sans Merci, in the days of the Intercert. Children, yes, there used to be an exam called the Intercert. And he really gets the atmosphere, the eerie atmosphere of the poem there, and she matches it, I think, in her delivery.
Very much so. And I think that, you know, Brian Eno is involved with this as well, and Nick Cave plays piano as well. So I think those kind of spectral shifting kind of soundscapes are excellent, and the only real backdrop that could be used here. Parts of this reminded me of John Cale and Lou Reed's brilliant homage to Andy Warhol's Songs for Drella, and in particular A Dream. She does Ozymandias by Shelley on this, which is the standout track for me. So I think those serene ambient backdrops and that more kind of spooked atmosphere we just heard there in La Belle Dame Sans Merci works really well and really brings out the aristocratic kind of nature of Marianne Faithfull's voice.
Okay, overall and stars from you, Lauren?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really fault it, but it's an album that I more admired than enjoyed, if that makes sense. So I'll go 3 out of 5.
3 from you. What are you saying, Alan?
Well, I'd give it a 3.5. I mean, Marianne Faithfull could read Palm Airs or A Filthy Limerick and load it with such gravitas, you'd have to sit up and listen. So 3.5 out of 5 for me.
All right, 3.5 from you. And I'm delighted that we just got confirmation in the last while that we will be speaking with Marianne Faithfull. We'll be speaking to her some stage this week. I'm not sure when we'll broadcast it, but we will let you know for sure. But I'm looking forward to that enormously. That's the second of our albums this evening. She Walks in Beauty, Marianne Faithfull and Warren Ellis. Let us move on to album number 3. The only first Irish artist that we've had in this evening's album reviews, Dublin-based musician Adrian Crowley. His 9th album, The Watchful Eye of the Stars, the follow-up to his 2017 Dark Eyed Messenger. Why don't I just actually start with a track called Bread and Wine.
It's taken me so long to write to you. Well, I just couldn't find the pen. And then there was the quest for writing paper, and it just went on from there. I have it in my mind to tell you more when the time is right. But meanwhile, I'll be playing waltzes for bread and wine, bread and wine.
There you go, Bread and Wine, the title of that track from Adrian Crowley's new album, The Watchful Eye of the Stars. Lauren, Adrian Crowley in recent times, there's been novel writing, short stories going on, a little bit of acting, I believe, as well. I think all of that is present here in The Watchful Eye of the Stars. You get a sense of an artist coming from several different angles at what he's doing.
Absolutely, and certainly the novel writing and the short story writing is definitely brought to the fore on this album. It's very... His lyrics have always been evocative and kind of based around nature and stuff like that. But this time, like, he's absolutely pushing the boat out on that point. And, like, even that song Bread and Wine, there's some lines in that I don't know if you could hear, but, you know, I wake up to the smell of the brine, the stray dogs follow me around, they seem to know their kind. A lot of the songs read like short stories, and they're so evocative and paint such brilliant, vivid images that it's such a pleasure to listen to these songs, because they're so succinct, but they're really pleasurable to listen to as well.
Yeah, again, the eye and the ear and the voice of the poet very much present here, Alan, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's got that kind of drowsy kind of baritone, and these are more spoken verses to me. Mm. He's got that kind of almost conversational voice. It's kind of well deep, and it's anchored in these tales of kind of, briny seafaring tales. He always uses kind of maritime imagery in his song. So these are, I suppose, more rhymes from the not-so-ancient mariner to carry on with the poetry kind of vibe. But, I've always saw him as kind of writing these kind of spooked chamber pop songs, and you could imagine him soundtracking a Tim Burton film. So there has always been a cinematic storytelling quality to his music that's really kind of to the fore in this album.
The other thing is, I mean, there are some of the songs he sings, some of the songs he kind of speaks and sings, but there's one Crow song where it's basically, it's like a long ballad. It's kind of a modern version, if you like, in some ways, of La Belle Dame Sans Merci. I think this comes from an actual experience. Is it you that were saying this, Lauren? A story from real life with his brother?
Yeah, apparently his brother brought a wounded crow home at some point, and Adrian Crowley wrote a short story about it that eventually made its way into song form on this album, on the song Crow Song, or the spoken word verse rather than a song. But there's again that sense of literature coming through his songwriting. It's always been there, but it's very much apparent on this album, than any of his other stuff.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a little bit of Crow Song.
I put you in the cardboard apple box, not sure if you'd make it to morning. In the spare room, I stood on the stone floor by the window and watched the lights across Galway Bay like smugglers' lanterns, and the trees bucking in the wind. Solitary crow.
Solitary crow with the crippled wing, the refrain that keeps coming back time and time again at the end of each verse in that Crow Song from Adrian Crowley. Alan, we were talking about Marianne Faithfull's voice earlier on. Adrian Crowley's voice, purely as a speaker, is extraordinary there.
Absolutely. I think he's always been, indebted to the likes of Will Oldham and Leonard Cohen and Nick Cave, and maybe even a touch of Robert Forster from the Go-Betweens with that kind of literary bent going on. That song you just played there for me is the only real clanker on the album. I didn't like it
like
at all.
It? Oh, I loved that. There you go.
It sounds like a self-parody to me. It made me laugh out loud when I heard it. There is much better material on the album. I think I Still See You Among Strangers is the best song on it. But yeah, yeah, you're right. Even the speaking voice, that kind of sense of sand and glue, as Bowie might say, that kind of gravelly kind of baritone, is very evocative and very beautiful, all right.
Did it work for you, that spoken word piece? I think it did, Lauren.
Yeah, I really liked it, actually. I love his voice anyway. I mean, his singing voice is amazing. And that song that Alan mentioned, I Still See You Among Strangers, really caught me off guard because he uses his voice in a higher register. And it's when you're used to this deep, earthy baritone, and it's great. And I think the fact that he's worked with producer John Parrish this time around has really pushed him out of his comfort zone. So it sounds like he's just more willing to try different things, and it really, really works.
And there's a song called Underwater Song, which actually has the album title within it, something about Under the Watchful Eye of the Stars is part of the lyric within that. That was another song that stood out for me. And as you said, Alan, water and maritime themes all over the album.
Very much so, very much so. Like the opening track, Northbound Stowaway, is about stowing away on a ship. And again, I return to, if I Still See You Among Strangers, it really sounds like he's singing from the hull of a ship itself.
All right. Stars from you first this time, Alan.
Well, it's a watchful 3 stars from me, Sean.
A watchful 3. And what are you saying, Lauren?
I think it's his best album in years, so 4 out of 5 for me.
Best album in years, says Lauren from Adrian Curley, and 4 out of 5 for The Watchful Eye of the Stars. We were also speaking about Marianne Faithfull and Warren Ellis on the album She Walks in Beauty and Teenage Fan Club and their new album Endless Arcade. Lauren Murphy and Alan Corr with me on this Friday night. And that is our lot for this evening and indeed for this week. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme, as was last night's, was produced by Olin McGarner. I didn't credit him last night, which is unforgivable, but I think he's forgiven me now. Talk to you on Monday. Have a great bank holiday weekend. We'll be giving you some highlights on Monday.